Joe Flom is an outlier, but he's not an outlier for the reasons you might think. By the end of the chapter, in fact, we'll see that it is possible to take the lessons of Joe Flom, apply them to the legal world of New York City, and predict the family background, age, and origins of the city's most powerful attorneys without knowing a single additional fact about them. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Lesson number one, the importance of being Jewish. One of Joe Flom's classmates at Harvard Law School was a man named Alexander Bickel. Like Flom, Bickel was the son of Eastern European Jewish immigrants from Brooklyn. Like Flom, Bickel had gone to public school in New York City and then City College. Like Flom, Bickel was a star in his law school class. In fact, before his career was cut short by cancer, Bickel would become perhaps the finest constitutional scholar of his generation. And like Flom and the rest of their law school classmates, Bickel went to Manhattan during hiring season over Christmas of 1947 to find himself a job. His first stop was at Mudge Rose, down on Wall Street, as traditional and stuffy as any firm of that era. Mudge Rose was founded in 1869. It was where Richard Nixon practiced in the years before he won the presidency in 1968. We're like the lady who only wants her name in the newspaper twice, when she's born and when she dies, one of the senior partners famously said. Bickel was taken around the firm and interviewed by one partner after another until he was led into the library to meet with the firm's senior partner. You can imagine the scene, a dark paneled room, an artfully frayed Persian carpet, rows upon rows of leather-bound legal volumes, oil paintings of Mr. Mudge and Mr. Rose on the wall. After they put me through the whole interview and everything, Bickel would say, many years later, I was brought to the senior partner, who took it upon himself to tell me that for a boy of my antecedents, and you can imagine how Bickel must have paused before giving that euphemism for his immigrant background, I certainly had come far, but I ought to understand how limited the possibilities of a firm like his were to hire a boy of my antecedents. And while he congratulated me on my progress, I should understand he certainly couldn't offer me a job. But they all enjoyed seeing me and all that. It is clear from the transcript of Bickel's reminiscences that his interviewer does not quite know what to do with that information. Bickel was, by the time of the interview, at the height of his reputation. He had argued cases before the Supreme Court. He had written brilliant books. Mudge Rose saying no to Bickel because of his antecedents was like the Chicago Bulls turning down Michael Jordan because they were uncomfortable with black kids from North Carolina. It didn't make any sense. But for stars? The interviewer asked, meaning wouldn't they have made an exception for you? Bickel. Stars, schmars. In the 1940s and 1950s, the old line law firms of New York operated like a private club. They were all headquartered in downtown Manhattan, in and around Wall Street, in somber, granite-faced buildings. The partners at the top firms graduated from the same Ivy League schools, attended the same churches, and summered in the same oceanside villages on Long Island. They wore conservative gray suits. Their partnerships were known as white shoe firms, in apparent reference to the white bucks favored at the country club or a cocktail party. And they were very particular in whom they hired. As Irwin Smigel wrote in The Wall Street Lawyer, his study of the old-line New York legal establishment, they were looking for lawyers who are Nordic, have pleasing personalities and clean-cut appearances, are graduates of the right schools, have the right social background and experience in the affairs of the world, and are endowed with tremendous stamina. A former law school dean, in discussing the qualities students needed to obtain a job, offers a somewhat more realistic picture.